In high enough concentrations, that which cures can also kill. Ezio nodded sadly. I'm in your debt once more. Here is your codex page.
Must you leave so soon?
Florence is safe, for now. But I still have work to do. Chapter 10
Ezio!
Beamed Mario, his beard bristlier than ever, his face burned by the Tuscan sun.
Welcome back!
Uncle!
Mario's face became more serious.
I can see from your face that you've been through much in the months since we last met. And when you're bathed and rested, you must tell me all.
He paused.
We have heard all the news from Florence, and I, even I, found myself praying that by some miracle you would be spared. But not only were you spared, you turned the tide against the Pazzi. The Templars will hate you for that, Ezio.
It is a hatred I reciprocate.
Rest first, then tell me all.
That evening the two men sat down together in Mario's study. Mario listened intently as Ezio told him all he knew of the events that had passed in Florence. He returned Vieri's codex page to his uncle, and then passed over the one he had been given by Lorenzo, describing the design it contained for the poison blade, and showing it to him. Mario was duly impressed, but fixed his attention on the new page.
My friend was not able to decipher more than the description of the weapon, said Ezio. That is as well. Not all the pages contain such instructions, and only those that do should be of any interest to him, said Mario, an underlying note of caution in his voice. In any case, only when the pages are reunited shall we be able to understand fully the meaning of the Codex. But this page, when we place it, together with Vieri's, with the others, should bring us a step further.
He rose, walked over to the bookcase that concealed the wall on which the Codex pages hung, swung it back, and studied where the new pages might go. One of them connected with those already in place. The other touched a corner of it.
It is interesting that Vieri and his father should have owned pages that were evidently close together, he said. Now, let us see what...
He broke off, concentrating. He said at last, but his voice was troubled. Does this bring us any further, Uncle?
I'm not sure. We may be just as much in the dark as ever, but there is definitely some reference to a prophet, not from the Bible, but either a living prophet or one who is to come.
Who could it be?
Let's not go too fast.
Mario brooded over the pages, his lips moving, speaking a language Ezio did not understand.
As far as I can make out, the text here roughly translates as, only the prophet may open it. And here, there's a reference to two pieces of Eden. But what that means, I do not know. We must be patient until we have more pages of the Codex.
I know the Codex is important, Uncle, but I have what is for me a more pressing reason to be here than to unravel its mystery. I seek the renegade, Jacopo de Pazzi.
He certainly travelled south after fleeing Florence,
Mario hesitated before continuing.
I had not meant to talk of this with you tonight, Ezio. But the matter is as urgent to me as I see it is to you, and we have to start our preparations soon. My old friend Roberto has been driven out of San Gimignano, and it has become once more a stronghold of the Templars. It is too close to Florence and to us to remain so. I believe that Jacopo may seek refuge there.
I have a list of the names of the other conspirators, said Ezio, taking it from his wallet and handing it to his uncle.
Good. Some of these men will have far less to fall back on than Jacopo, and may be easy to root out. I'll send spies out into the countryside at dawn to see what they can discover about them, and in the meantime we must prepare to retake San Gimignano.
By all means make your men ready, but for me there is no time to waste if I'm to bring these murderers down. Mario considered.
Perhaps you are right. A man alone can often breach walls which an army cannot. And we should bring them down while they still think they are safe. He considered for a moment.
So, I give you my permission. You go on ahead and see what you can discover. I know you are more than able to look after yourself these days.
Uncle, my thanks.
Not so fast, Ezio. I grant you this leave on one condition.
Which is?
That you delay your departure for a week.
A week? If you are to go out into the field alone, with no backup, you will need more than these Codex weapons to help you.
You are a man now, and a brave fighter for the Assassins, but your reputation will make the Templars even hungrier for your blood, and I know that there are still skills which you lack.
Ezio shook his head impatiently.
No, Uncle, I am sorry, but a week!
Mario frowned, but raised his voice only slightly. It was enough.
I have heard good things of you, Ezio, but also bad. You lost control when you killed Francesco, and you allowed sentiment over Christina to tempt you from your path. Your whole duty now is to the Creed, for if you neglect it, there may be no world left for you to enjoy.
He drew himself up.
I speak with your father's voice when I command your obedience.
Ezio had watched his uncle grow in stature, even in size, as he spoke. And painful as it was to accept, he acknowledged the truth of what he had been told. Bitterly, he bowed his head.
Good, said Mario more kindly. And you will thank me for this. Your new combat training begins in the morning. And remember, the preparation is all.
A week later, armed and ready, Ezio rode out for San Gimignano. Mario had told him to make contact with one of the condottieri patrols he had posted within sight of the town to keep track of its comings and goings, and he joined one of their encampments for his first night away from Monteriggioni. The sergeant in command, a tough, battle-scarred man of 25, whose name was Gambalto, gave him a slab of bread with pecorino and a mug of heavy vernaccia, and while he was eating and drinking, told him the news.
I think it's a shame Antonio Maffei ever left Volterra. He's got a bee in his bonnet about Lorenzo and thinks the Duke crushed his hometown, whereas all he did was bring it under the wing of Florence. Now Maffei's gone mad. He set himself up at the top of the cathedral tower, surrounded himself with patsy archers, and spends each day spouting scripture and arrows in equal measure. God knows what his plan is, to convert the citizens to his cause with his sermons, or kill them off with his arrows. The ordinary people of San Gimignano hate him, but as long as he continues his reign of terror, the city is powerless against him. So he needs to be neutralized. Well, that would certainly weaken the patsy power base in the city.
How well defended are they?
Plenty of men on the watchtowers and at the gates, but they change the guard at dawn. Then a man like you might be able to get over the walls and into the city unseen.
Ezio mused, wondering whether this was a distraction from his own mission to hunt down Jacopo. But he reflected that he must be able to see the bigger picture. This Maffei was a patsy supporter, and it was Ezio's wider duty as an assassin to unseat this madman. By sunrise the following day, any especially attentive citizen of San Gimignano might have noticed a slim, grey-eyed, hooded figure gliding like a ghost through the streets which led to the cathedral square. The market traders were already setting up their stalls, but it was the ebb of the day's cycle, and the guards, bored and dispirited, leant on their halberds and dozed. The western side of the campanile was still in deep shadow, and no one saw the black-clad figure climb up it with all the quiet ease and grace of a spider. The priest, gaunt, hollow-eyed and wild-haired, was already in position. Four tired patsy crossbowmen had also taken up their places, one at each corner of the tower. But as if he did not trust the crossbowmen alone to protect him, Antonio Maffei, though clutching a Bible in his left hand, held a rondel dagger in his right. He was already orating, and as Ezio drew close to the top of the tower, he began to catch Maffei's words.
"Citizens of San Gimignano, heed well my words. You must repent, repent, and seek forgiveness. Join me in prayer, my children, so that together we may stand against the darkness which has fallen across our beloved Tuscany. Give ear, O heavens, and I shall speak, and hear, O earth, the words of my mouth. Let my teaching drop as the rain, my speech distill as the dew, as raindrops on the tender herbs, as showers on the grass. For I proclaim the name of the Lord. He is the rock. His work is perfect, for all his ways are just. Righteous and upright is he, but they who have corrupted themselves, they are not his children. A blemished, perverse, and crooked generation. Citizens of San Gimignano, do you thus deal with the Lord? O foolish and unwise people, is he not your father who bore you? By the light of his mercy, be cleansed.
Ezio leapt lightly over the parapet of the tower and took up a position near the trapdoor which opened onto the stairway that led below. The bowmen struggled to bring their crossbows to bear on him, but the range was short, and he had the element of surprise. He crouched and grasped the heels of one, toppling him over the parapet, howling to his death on the cobblestones 200 feet below. Before the others could react, he had rounded on a second, stabbing him in the arm. The man looked astonished at the small wound, but then turned grey and collapsed, the life draining from him in an instant. Ezio had strapped his new poison blade to his arm, for there was no time for fair mortal combat now. He whirled on the third, who had dropped his crossbow and was trying to get past him to the stairs. As he reached them, Ezio kicked him in the rump, and he stumbled down the wooden steps, head first, bones snapping as he crashed down the first flight. The last raised his hands and burbled something. Ezio looked down and saw that the man had pissed in his hose. He stepped aside and, with an ironic bow, allowed the terrified bowman to scamper down the stairs after the broken ruins of his comrade. Then he was hit hard on the back of the neck by the heavy steel pommel of a dagger. Maffei had recovered from his shock at the attack and closed on Ezio from behind. Ezio staggered forward.
"I will put you on your knees, sinner!" screamed the priest, foam appearing at the sides of his mouth. "Beg forgiveness!"
Why do people always waste their time in talk, thought Ezio, who had had time to recover and turn while the priest was speaking. The two men circled each other in the narrow space. Maffei slashed and lunged with his heavy dagger. He was clearly an unskilled fighter, but desperation and his fanaticism made him very dangerous indeed, and Ezio had to dance out of the way of the erratically swinging blade more than once, unable to land a blow himself. But at last he was able to catch the priest's wrist and pull him forwards so that their chests were touching.
"I will send you whimpering to hell!" snarled Maffei.
"Show some respect for death, my friend," Ezio retorted.
"I'll give you respect!"
"Give in. I'll give you time to pray." Maffei spat in Ezio's eyes, forcing him to let go. Then, screaming, he plunged his dagger at Ezio's left forearm, only to see the blade slide harmlessly to one side, deflected by the metal bracer in place there.
"What demon protects you?" he snapped. "You talk too much," Ezio said, pushing his own dagger a little way into the priest's neck and tensing the muscles in his forearm.
As the poison flowed through the blade into Maffei's jugular, the priest stiffened, opened his mouth, but nothing but foul breath came forth. Then he pushed himself away from Ezio, staggered back to the parapet, steadied himself an instant, and then fell forward into the arms of death. Ezio stooped over Maffei's corpse. From his robes he extracted a letter, which he opened and quickly scanned.
"Padrone, it is with fear in my heart that I write this. The prophet has arrived. I feel it. The very birds don't act as they should. They swirl aimlessly round the sky. I see them from my tower. I will not attend our meeting as you required, for I can no longer remain thus exposed in public view, for fear that the demon may find me. Forgive me, but I must heed my inner voice. May the Father of Understanding guide you, and guide me. Brother A."
Gambalto was right, thought Ezio. The man had lost his mind. Somberly, remembering his uncle's admonition, He closed the priest's eyes, saying as he did so, "Requiescat in pace." Aware that the archer to whom he'd shown mercy might have raised the alarm, he looked down over the tower's parapet at the town below, but could see no activity to worry him. The Patsy guards still lounged at their posts, and the market had opened, doing a thin trade. No doubt the crossbowman was by now halfway across the countryside, making his way home, finding desertion preferable to a court-martial and possibly torture. He pushed his blade back into its mechanism, hidden on his forearm, taking care to touch it only with a gloved hand, and picked his way down the stairs of the tower. The sun was up, and it would make him too easily visible if he were to climb down the outside of the campanile. When he rejoined Mario's troop of mercenaries, Gambalto greeted him in an excited mood. "Your presence brings us good fortune," he said. "Our scouts have tracked down Archbishop Salviati."
"Where?"
"Not far from here. Do you see that mansion on the hill over there?"
"Yes."
"He's there." Gambalto remembered himself. "But first, I must ask you, Capitano, how you fared in the city."
"There will be no more sermons of hatred from that tower."
"The people will bless you, Capitano."
"I am no captain."
"To us you are," said Gambalto simply. "Take a detachment of men from here. Salviati is heavily guarded, and the mansion is an old, fortified building."
"Very well," said Ezio.
"It is good that the eggs are close together, almost in one nest."
"The others cannot be far away, Ezio. We will endeavour to find them during your absence."
Ezio selected a dozen of Gambalto's best hand-to-hand combat fighters, and led them on foot across the fields that separated them from the mansion where Salviati had taken refuge. He had his men fanned out, but within calling distance of one another, and the Patsy outposts Salviati had put into position were easily either avoided or neutralized. But Ezio lost two of his own men in the approach. Ezio had hoped to take the mansion by surprise before its occupants were aware of his attack, but when he came close to the solid main gates, a figure appeared on the walls above them, dressed in the robes of an archbishop, gripping the battlements with claw-like hands. A vulturine face peered down, and was quickly withdrawn. "It's Salviati," Ezio said to himself. There were no other guards posted outside the gates. Ezio beckoned to his men to come up close to the walls, so that archers would not have enough of an angle to fire down at them. There was no doubt that Salviati would have concentrated what remained of his bodyguard inside the walls, which were high and thick enough to seem unbreachable. Ezio was wondering whether he should once again attempt climbing up and over the walls, and open the gates from the inside to admit his troops, but he knew that the Patsy guards inside would be alerted to his presence. Motioning to his men to stay out of sight, huddled against the walls, he crouched low, and made his way back through the tall grass the short distance to where the body of one of their enemies lay. Quickly, he stripped and donned the man's uniform, bundling his own clothes under his arm. He rejoined his men, who at first bristled at the sight of a supposed Patsy approaching, and handed his clothes over to one of them. Then he banged on the gates with the pommel of his sword.
"Open," he cried, "in the name of the Father of Understanding."
A tense minute passed. Ezio stood back so that he could be seen from the walls, and then he heard the sound of heavy bolts being drawn. As soon as the gates began to open, Ezio and his men stormed them, heaving them back and scattering the guards within. They found themselves in a courtyard, around which the mansion formed itself in three wings. Salviati himself stood at the top of a flight of stairs in the middle of the main wing. A dozen burly men, fully armed, stood between him and Ezio. More occupied the courtyard.
"Filthy treachery," cried the archbishop, "but you will not get out again as easily as you've got in."
He raised his voice to a commanding roar.
"Kill them! Kill them all!"
The Patsy troops closed in, all but surrounding Ezio's men. But the Patsy had not trained under such a man as Mario Auditore, and despite the odds against them, Ezio's condottieri engaged successfully with their opponents in the courtyard, while Ezio sprang towards the stairs. He released his poison blade and slashed at the men surrounding Salviati. It didn't matter where he hit. Every time he struck and drew blood, be it only at a man's cheek, that man died in a heartbeat.
"You are indeed a demon, from the fourth ring of the ninth circle," Salviati spoke in a shuddering voice, as at last he and Ezio confronted one another.
Ezio retracted the poison blade, but drew his battle dagger. He grasped Salviati by the scruff of his cope and held the blade to the archbishop's neck.
"The Templars lost their Christianity when they discovered banking," he said evenly. "Do you not know your own gospel? Thou canst not serve God and Mammon?
But now is your chance to redeem yourself. Tell me, where is Jacopo?"
Salviati glared in defiance.
"You will never find him."
Ezio drew the blade gently but firmly across the man's gizzard, drawing a little blood.
"You'll have to do better than that, Arcivescovo."
"Night guards us when we meet. Now finish your business."
"So you skulk like the murderers you are under cover of darkness. Thank you for that. I will ask you once more, where?"
"The Father of Understanding knows that what I do now is for the greater good," said Salviati coldly,
and suddenly seizing Ezio's wrist with both his hands, he forced the dagger deep into his own throat.
"Tell me!"
yelled Ezio. But the archbishop, his mouth bubbling blood, had already sunk at his feet, his gorgeous yellow and white robes blossoming red. It was to be several months before Ezio had further news of the conspirators he sought. Meanwhile, he worked with Mario to plan how they might retake San Gimignano and free its citizens from the cruel yoke of the Templars, but they had learned a lesson from the last time and maintained an iron grip on the city. Knowing that the Templars would also be searching for the still-missing pages of the Codex, Ezio roamed far and wide in quest of them himself, but to no avail. The pages already in the possession of the assassins remained concealed under Mario's strict guard, for without them, the secret of the creed would never yield to the Templars. Then, one day, a courier from Florence rode up to Monteriggioni, bearing a letter from Leonardo for Ezio. Quickly, he reached for a mirror, for he knew his friend's habit, being left-handed, of writing backwards, though the spidery scrawl would have been difficult for the most talented reader, unfamiliar with it, to decipher in any circumstances. Ezio broke the seal and read eagerly, his heart lifting at every line.
"Gentile Ezio, Duke Lorenzo has asked me to send you news of Bernardo Baroncelli. It seems that the man managed to take ship for Venice, and from thence secretly made his way incognito to the court of the Ottoman Sultan at Constantinople, planning to seek refuge there. But he spent no time in Venice, and did not learn that the Venetians had recently signed a peace with the Turks. They have even sent their second-best painter, Gentile Bellini, to make a portrait of Sultan Mehmet. So that when he arrived, and his true identity became known, he was arrested. Of course, then you can imagine the letters that flew between the Sublime Porte and Venice. But the Venetians are our allies too, at least for now, and Duke Lorenzo is nothing if not a master diplomat. Baroncelli was sent in chains back to Florence, and once here, he was put to the question. But he was stubborn, or foolish, or brave, I know not which. He withstood the rack and the white-hot tongs and the floggings and the rats nibbling at his feet, only telling us that the conspirators used to meet by night in an old crypt under Santa Maria Novella. Of course a search was made, but yielded nothing, so he was hanged. I have done rather a good sketch of him hanging, which I will show you when we next meet. I think it is, anatomically speaking, quite accurate. Distinti saluti. Your friend, Leonardo da Vinci."
"It is good that the man is dead," commented Mario when Ezio showed him the letter. "He was the type who would steal straw from his mother's kennel. But at last it brings us no nearer to discovering what the Templars plan next, or even the whereabouts of Jacopo."
Ezio had found time to visit his mother and his sister, who continued to while away their days in the serenity of the convent, watched over by the kindly abbess. Maria had, he saw to his sadness, made as much of a recovery as she would ever make. Her hair had turned prematurely grey,
and there were fine crow's feet lines at the corners of her eyes. But she had achieved an inner calm, and when she spoke of her dead husband and sons, it was with affectionate and proud remembrance. But the sight of little Petruccio's pearwood box of eagle's plumes, which she kept on her bedside table, could still bring tears to her eyes. As for Claudia, she was now a novitia, but although Ezio regretted what he saw as a waste of her beauty and her spirit, he acknowledged that there was a light in her face which caused him to bow to her decision and be happy for her. He visited them again over Christmas, and in the new year took up his training again, though inside himself he was boiling over with impatience. To counter this, Mario had made him joint commander of his castle, and Ezio tirelessly sent out his own spies and scouts to range the country in quest of the quarry he implacably sought. And then, at last, there was news. One morning in late spring, Gambalto appeared in the doorway of the map room where Ezio and Mario were deep in conference, his eyes ablaze.
"Signori, we've found Stefano de Bagnoni. He has taken refuge in the Abbey Asmodeo, only a few leagues to the south. He has been right under our noses all this time."
"They hang together like the dogs they are," snapped Mario, his stubby workman's fingers quickly tracing a route on the map before him. He looked at Ezio. "But he is a lead dog, Jacopo's secretary. If we cannot beat something out of him..." But Ezio was already giving orders for his horse to be saddled and made ready. Swiftly, he made his way to his quarters and armed himself, strapping on the Codex weapons and choosing, this time, the original spring blade over the poisoned one. He had replaced Leonardo's original hemlock distillation with henbane on the advice of Monteriggioni's doctor, and the poison sack in its hilt was full. He had decided he would use the poison blade with discretion, since there was always the risk of delivering himself a fatal dose. For this reason, and because his fingers were covered with small scars, he now wore supple but heavy leather gloves when using either blade. The abbey was located near Monticiano, whose ancient castle brooded over the hill town. It was set in the sunlit hollow of a gentle slope, packed with cypress trees. It was a new building, perhaps only 100 years old, built of expensive imported yellow sandstone, and built round a vast courtyard with a church at its centre. The gates stood wide open, and the monks of the abbey's order, in their ochre habits, could be seen working in the fields and orchards which had been cleared around the building, and in the vineyard above it. The wine of the monastery attached to the abbey was famous, and was exported even to Paris. Part of Ezio's preparation had been to provide himself with a monk's habit of his own, and having left his horse with an ostler at the inn where he had taken a room under the guise of a state courier, he donned his disguise before arriving at the abbey. Soon after his arrival, he spotted Stefano, deep in conversation with the abbey's hospitarius, a corpulent monk who looked as if he had taken on the shape of one of the wine barrels he so evidently frequently emptied. Ezio managed to manoeuvre himself close enough to listen without being noticed.
"Let us pray, brother," said the monk.
"Pray," said Stefano, whose black garb contrasted with all the sunny colours around him. He looked like a spider on a pancake.
"For what?"
he added sardonically.
The monk looked surprised. "For the Lord's protection."
"If you think the Lord has any interest in our affairs, Brother Girolamo, you have another think coming. But please, by all means, continue to delude yourself if it helps you to pass the time." Brother Girolamo was shocked.
"What you speak is blasphemy."
"No, I speak truth."
"But to deny his most exalted presence
is the only rational response when faced with a declaration that there exists some invisible madman in the sky.
And believe me, if our precious Bible is anything to go by, he's completely lost his mind." "How can you say such things? You are yourself a priest."
"I am an administrator. I use these clerical robes to bring me closer to the accursed Medici so that I may chop them off at the knees in the service of my true master. But first, there is still the business of this assassin, Ezio. For too long he has been a thorn in our side, and we must pluck him out."
"There you speak truth, that unholy demon."
"Well,
said Stefano with a crooked smile. "At least we agree on something."
Girolamo lowered his voice.
"They say the devil has given him unnatural speed and strength."
Stefano looked at him.
"The devil?"
"No, my friend, these are gifts he gave himself through rigorous training over years." He paused, his scrawny body bent at a pensive angle. "You know, Girolamo, I find it disturbing that you are so unwilling to credit people for their own circumstances. I think you'd make victims out of the entire world if you could."
"I forgive your lack of faith and your forked tongue," replied Girolamo piously. "You are still one of God's children."
"I told you," Stefano began with some asperity, but then spread his hands and gave it up.
"Oh, what's the use? Enough of this. It's like speaking to the wind." "I will pray for you."
"As you wish, but do so quietly. I must keep watch. Until we have this assassin dead and buried, no Templar can drop his guard for an instant."
The monk withdrew with a bow, and Stefano was left alone in the courtyard. The bell for first and second Kauma had sounded, and all the community were in the abbey church. Ezio emerged from the shadows like a wraith. The sun shone with the silent heaviness of midday. Stefano, crow-like, stalked up and down by the north wall, restless, impatient, possessed. When he saw Ezio, he showed no surprise at all.
"I am unarmed," he said. "I fight with the mind."
"To use that, you must remain alive. Can you defend yourself?"
"Would you kill me in cold blood?"
"I will kill you because it is necessary that you die."
"A good answer. But do you not think I may have secrets that would be useful to you?"
"I can see that you would not bow under any torture."
Stefano looked at him appraisingly. "I will take that as a compliment, though I am not so sure myself. However, it is of merely academic significance."
He paused before continuing in his thin voice.
"You have missed your chance, Ezio. The die is cast. The assassin's cause is lost. I know you will kill me whatever I do or say, and that I shall be dead before the midday mass is over, but my death will profit you nothing. The Templars already have you in check, and soon it will be checkmate."
"You cannot be sure of that."
"I am about to meet my Maker, if he exists at all. It will be refreshing to find out. In the meantime, why should I lie?"
Ezio released his dagger.
"How clever," commented Stefano. "What will they think of next?"
"Redeem yourself," said Ezio. "Tell me what you know."
"What do you wish to know?" "The whereabouts of my master, Jacopo?" Stefano smiled. "That is easy. He meets our confederates soon, at night, in the shadow of the Roman gods." He paused. "I hope that makes you happy, for nothing you can do will make me say more. And it is in any case of no significance, for I know in my heart that you are too late. My only regret is that I will not see your undoing. But who knows? Perhaps there is an afterlife, and I shall be able to look down on your death. But for the present, let us get this unpleasant business over with."
The abbey bell was ringing once more. Ezio had little time.
"I think you could teach me much," he said.
Stefano looked at him sadly.
"Not in this world," he said.
He opened the neck of his gown.
"But do me the favour of sending me quickly into the night."
Ezio stabbed once, deeply, and with deadly accuracy.
"There are the ruins of a temple of Mithras to the southwest of San Gimignano," said Mario thoughtfully when Ezio returned. "They are the only Roman ruins of any significance for miles around. And you say he spoke of the shadow of the Roman gods?"
"Those were his words."
"And the Templars are to meet there, soon?"
"Yes."
"Then we must not delay. We must keep a vigil there from this night on."
Ezio was despondent.
Da Bagnone told me it was already too late to stop them. Mario grinned.
Well then, it's up to us to prove him wrong.
It was the third night of the vigil. Mario had returned to his base to continue his schemes against the Templars in San Gimignano, and left Ezio with 5 trusted men, Gambalto among them, to keep watch concealed in the dense woods which fringed the isolated, desolate ruins of the Temple of Mithras. This was a large set of buildings developed over centuries, whose last occupant had indeed been Mithras, the god the Roman army had adopted, but which contained more ancient chapels, once consecrated to Minerva, Venus, and Mercury. There was also a theatre attached to the complex, whose stage was still solid, though faced by a broken semicircle of terraced stone benches, the home now of scorpions and mice, backed by a crumbling wall and flanked by broken columns where owls had made their nests. Everywhere ivy climbed, and tough buddleia shouldered its way through the cracks it had made in the stained and decaying marble. Over all, the moon cast a ghastly light, and, used though they were to tackling mortal foes unafraid, one or two of the men were distinctly nervous. Ezio had told himself that they would keep watch for a week, but he knew it would be hard for the men to keep their nerve in this place for that long, for the ghosts of the pagan past were a strong presence here. But towards midnight, as the assassins ached in every limb from lack of activity and keeping still, they heard the faint tinkling of harness. Ezio and his men braced themselves. Soon afterwards, there rode through the complex 12 soldiers bearing torches and headed by 3 men. They were making for the theatre. Ezio and his condottieri shadowed them there. The men dismounted and formed a protective circle round their 3 leaders. Watching, Ezio recognized with triumph the face of the man he had sought so long, Jacopo de Pazzi, a harassed-looking greybeard of 60. He was accompanied by one man he did not know and another whom he did, the beak-nosed, crimson-cowled, unmistakable figure of Rodrigo Borgia. Grimly, Ezio attached the poison blade to the mechanism on his right wrist.
"You know why I have called this meeting," Rodrigo began. "I have given you more than enough time, Jacopo, but you have yet to redeem yourself."
"I am sorry, Commendatore. I have done all that is within my power. The assassins have outflanked me."
"You have not regained Florence." Jacopo bowed his head.
"You have not even been able to strike off the head of Ezio Auditore, a mere cub. And with every victory over us, he gains strength, becomes more dangerous." "It was my nephew Francesco's fault," babbled Jacopo. "His impatience made him reckless. I tried to be the voice of reason."
"More like the voice of cowardice," put in the third man harshly.
Jacopo turned to him with markedly less respect than he had shown Rodrigo.
"Ah, Messer Emilio. Perhaps we would have been better served had you sent us weaponry of quality, instead of the rubbish you Venetians call armaments. But you Barbarigi were always cheapskates."
"Enough," thundered Rodrigo.
He turned again to Jacopo.
"We put our faith in you and your family. And how have you repaid us? With inaction and incompetence. You retake San Gimignano. Bravo. And there you sit. You even allow them to attack you there. Brother Maffei was a valuable servant of our cause. And you could not even save your own secretary, a man whose brain was worth 10 of yours."
"Altezza, just give me the chance to make amends, and you will see."
Jacopo looked at the hardened faces surrounding him.
"I will show you."
Rodrigo allowed his features to soften. He even sketched a smile.
"Jacopo, we know the best course to take now. You must leave it to us. Come here. Let me embrace you."
Hesitantly, Jacopo obeyed. Rodrigo put his left arm round his shoulders, and with his right drew a stiletto from his robes, and slid it firmly between Jacopo's ribs.
Jacopo pushed his way back off the knife, while Rodrigo looked at him in the same way as a father might regard his errant son. Jacopo clutched his wound. Rodrigo had not penetrated any vital organ. Perhaps. But now Emilio Barbarigo stepped up to him. Instinctively, Jacopo held up his bloodied hands to protect himself, for Emilio had drawn a wicked-looking basilard, one of its edges roughly serrated, and with a deep blood gutter along the side of its blade.
"No," whimpered Jacopo. "I have done my best. I have always served the cause loyally, all my life. Please, please don't."
Emilio gave a brutal laugh.
"Please don't what, you snivelling piece of shit?"
And he tore Jacopo's doublet open, immediately dragging the serrated blade of his heavy dagger across Jacopo's chest, tearing it open. Jacopo screamed and fell first to his knees and then onto his side, writhing in blood. He looked up to see Rodrigo Borgia standing over him, a narrow sword in his hand.
"Master, have pity," Jacopo managed to say. "It is not too late. Give me one last chance to put matters right."
Then he choked on his own blood.
"Oh, Jacopo," said Rodrigo gently,
"how you have disappointed me." He raised his blade and thrust it through Jacopo's neck with such force that the point emerged at the nape, seeming to sever the spinal cord. He twisted it in the wound before drawing it out, slowly. Jacopo raised himself, his mouth full of blood, but he was already dead and sank back, twitching, until he was at last still. Rodrigo wiped his sword on the dead man's clothes, and drawing his cloak aside, sheathed it.
"What a mess," he murmured.
Then he turned, looked directly in Ezio's direction, grinned, and shouted,
"You can come out now, assassin. My apologies for having robbed you of your prize."
Before he could react, Ezio found himself grabbed by two guards whose tunics bore a red cross within a yellow shield, the coat of arms of his archenemy. He called to Gambalto, but there was no answer from any of his men. He was dragged onto the stage of the ancient theatre.
"Greetings, Ezio," said Rodrigo. "I'm sorry about your men, but did you really think I didn't expect to find you here? That I didn't plan for you to come? Do you think Stefano da Bagnoni all but told you the exact time and place of this meeting without my knowledge and approval? Of course, we had to make it seem difficult, or you might have sensed a trap." He laughed.
"Poor Ezio.
You see, we've been at this game a lot longer than you have. I had my guards hidden in the woods here long before you even arrived. And I'm afraid your men were taken as much by surprise as you were. But I wanted to see you again alive before you leave us. Call it a whim. And now I am satisfied."
Rodrigo smiled and addressed the guards holding Ezio's arms.
"Thank you. You may kill him now."
Together with Emilio Barbarigo, he mounted his horse and rode away, together with the guards who had accompanied him there. Ezio watched him go. He thought fast. There were the two burly men holding him, and how many others still concealed in the woods? How many men had Borgia set in place to ambush his own troop?
"Say your prayers, boy,"
one of his captors told him. "Look," said Ezio, "I know you're only obeying orders. So if you release me, I'll spare your lives. How about that?" The guard who had spoken looked amused.
"Well, listen to you. I don't think I've ever come across anyone able to keep their sense of humour like you at a moment like—"
But he didn't get to finish his sentence. Ezio sprang out his hidden blade and, taking advantage of their surprise, cut at the man holding him on his right. The poison did its work, and the man staggered back, falling not far away. Before the other guard could react, Ezio had thrust his blade deep into his armpit, the one spot armour could not cover. Free, He leapt into the shadows at the edge of the stage and waited. He didn't have to wait long. From out of the woods, the other 10 guards Rodrigo had hidden there emerged, some warily scanning the fringes of the theatre, others bending over their fallen comrades. Moving with the deadly speed of a lynx, Ezio threw himself among them, slashing at them with sickle-like cuts, concentrating on any part of their bodies that was exposed. Already frightened and taken half off guard, the Borgia troops reeled before him, and Ezio had slain 5 of their number before the others took to their heels and vanished, bellowing in panic, into the woods. Ezio watched them go. They wouldn't report back to Rodrigo unless they wanted to be hanged for incompetence, and it would take a while before they were missed, and Rodrigo learned that his satanic plan had misfired. Ezio knelt over the body of Jacopo de Pazzi, battered and robbed of all dignity. All that was left was the shell of a pathetic, desperate old man. "You poor wretch," he said. "I was angry when I saw that Rodrigo had robbed me of my rightful prey, but now... now..." He fell silent and reached over to close the Patsy's eyes. Then he realized that the eyes were looking at him. By some miracle, Jacopo was still, just, alive. He opened his mouth to speak, but no sound could come. It was clear that he was in the last extremes of agony. Ezio's first thought was to leave him to a lingering death, but the eyes pleaded with him. "Show mercy," he remembered, "even when you yourself have been shown none." That, too, was part of the creed. "God give you peace," he said, kissing Jacopo's forehead as he pushed his dagger firmly into his old adversary's heart. Chapter 11 When Ezio returned to Florence and broke the news to Duke Lorenzo of the death of the last of the Pazzi, Lorenzo was delighted, but saddened that the security of Florence and of the Medici had had to be bought at the cost of so much blood. Lorenzo preferred to find diplomatic solutions to differences, but that desire made him an exception among his peers, the rulers of the other city-states of Italy. He rewarded Ezio with a ceremonial cape which conferred on him the freedom of the city of Florence. "This is a most gracious gift, Altezza," Ezio told him, "but I fear I will have little leisure to enjoy the benefits it confers on me." Lorenzo was surprised. "What? Do you intend to leave again soon? I had hoped that you would stay, reopen your family palazzo, and take up a position in the city's administration, working with me." Ezio bowed, but said, "I'm sorry to say that it is my belief that our troubles have not come to an end with the fall of the Pazzi. They were but one tentacle of a greater beast. My intention now is to go to Venice."
"Venice?"
"Yes. The man who was with Rodrigo Borgia at the meeting with Francesco is a member of the Barbarigo family."
"One of the most powerful families in La Serenissima. Are you saying this man is dangerous?"
"He is allied to Rodrigo."
Lorenzo considered for a moment, then spread his hands. "I let you go with the utmost regret, Ezio. But I know that I shall never be out of your debt, which means, in turn, that I have no power to command you. Besides, I have a feeling that the work you are engaged on will in the long run be of benefit to our city, even though I may not live to see it."
"Don't say that, Altezza."
Lorenzo smiled. "I hope I am wrong, but living in this country at this time is like living on the rim of Vesuvius, dangerous and uncertain."
Before leaving, Ezio brought news and gifts to Annetta, though it was painful to him to visit his former family home, and he would not enter it. He also studiously avoided the Calfucci mansion, but he did call on Paola and found her gracious but distracted, as if her mind were somewhere else. His last port of call was at his friend Leonardo's workshop, but when he got there he found only Agnolo and Innocento about, and the place had the look of being closed up. There was no sign of Leonardo. Agnolo smiled and greeted him as he arrived.
"Ciao, Ezio, it's been a long time."
"Too long.
Ezio looked about him, questioningly. "You're wondering where Leonardo is?"
"Has he left?"
"Yes, but not forever. He's taken some of his material with him, but he couldn't take it all, so Innocento and I are looking after it while he's away."
"And where has he gone?"
"It's funny. The maestro was in negotiations with the Sforza in Milan, but then the Conte de Pexaro invited him to spend some time in Venice. He's to complete a set of 5 family portraits."
Agnolo smiled knowingly.
"As if that'll ever happen. But it seems that the Council of Venice is interested in his engineering work, and they're providing him with a workshop, staff, the lot. So, dear Ezio, if you need him, that is where you'll need to go."
"But that is exactly where I'm going," cried Ezio. "This is splendid news.
When did he leave?"
2 days ago. But you'll have no difficulty catching up with him. He's got a huge wagon, absolutely loaded with his stuff, and a couple of oxen to draw it."
"Any of his people with him?"
"Just the wagoners and a couple of outriders in case of trouble. They've taken the Ravenna road." Ezio took with him only what he could pack into his saddlebags, and, travelling alone, had been riding only a day and a half when, at a bend in the road, he came upon a heavy ox-drawn cart equipped with a canvas canopy, beneath which any amount of machinery and models was carefully stowed. The wagoners stood at the side of the road, scratching their heads and looking hot and bothered, while the outriders, 2 slightly built boys armed with crossbows and lances, kept watch from a nearby knoll. Leonardo was nearby, apparently setting up some kind of leverage system, when he looked up and saw Ezio.
"Hello, Ezio, what luck!"
"Leonardo, what's going on?"
"I seem to have run into a bit of trouble. One of the cart wheels..."
He pointed to where one of the rear wheels had worked its way off the axle.
"The problem is that we need the wagon lifted clear so that we can refit the wheel, but we just don't have the manpower to do it. And this lever I've botched together isn't going to lift it high enough. So, do you think..."
"Of course." Ezio beckoned to the 2 wagoners, heavily built men who'd be more used to him than the lissom outriders, and between the 3 of them they were able to hoist the wagon up high enough and hold it there long enough for Leonardo to slip the wheel back onto the axle and peg it securely. While he was doing this, Ezio, straining with the others to keep the wagon up, looked in at its contents. Among them, unmistakably, was the bat-like structure he'd seen before. It looked as if it had undergone many modifications. Once the wagon had been repaired, Leonardo took up his seat on its front bench with one of the wagoners, while the other walked at the head of the oxen. The outriders patrolled restlessly both ahead and to the rear. Ezio kept his horse at a walk next to Leonardo, and they talked. It had been a very long time since their last meeting, and they had much to talk about. Ezio was able to bring Leonardo up to date, and Leonardo talked of his new commissions, and of his excitement at the prospect of seeing Venice.
"I'm so delighted to have you as a travelling companion. Mind you, you'd get there much faster if you didn't travel at my pace."
"It's a pleasure. And I want to make sure you get there safely."
"I have my outriders."
"Leonardo, don't misunderstand me, but even highwaymen still wet behind the ears could flick those 2 away as easily as you'd flick away a gnat."
Leonardo looked surprised, then offended, then amused.
"Then I'm doubly glad of your company."
He looked sly. "And I have an idea it's not just for sentimental reasons that you'd like to see me get there in one piece."
Ezio smiled but did not reply. Instead, he said, "I notice you're still working on that bat contraption."
"Eh?"
"You know what I mean."
"Oh, that. It's nothing. Just something I've been tinkering away at. But I couldn't leave it behind."
"What is it?"
Leonardo was reluctant.
"I don't really like to talk about things before they're ready."
"Leonardo, you can trust me, surely?"
Ezio lowered his voice. "After all, I've trusted you with secrets."
Leonardo struggled with himself, then relaxed.
"All right, but you must tell no one else."
"Promesso."
"Anyone would think you mad if you did tell them," Leonardo continued, but his voice was excited.
"Listen. I think I have found a way to make a man fly."
Ezio looked at him and laughed in total disbelief.
"I can see a time coming when you might want to wipe that smile off your face," said Leonardo good-naturedly.
He changed the subject then and started to talk about Venice, La Serenissima, aloof from the rest of Italy, and often looking eastwards more than westwards, both for trade and in trepidation, for the Ottoman Turks held sway as far as halfway up the northern Adriatic coast these days. He talked of the beauty and the treachery of Venice, of the city's dedication to money-making, of its richesse, its weird construction, a city of canals rising out of fenland and built on a foundation of hundreds of thousands of huge wooden stakes, its ferocious independence, and its political power. Not 300 years earlier, the Doge of Venice had diverted an entire crusade from the Holy Land to serve his own purposes, to destroy all commercial and military competition and opposition to his city-state, and to bring the Byzantine Empire to its knees. He talked of the secret ink-dark backwaters, the towering candle-lit palazzi, the curious dialect of Italian they spoke, the silence that hovered, the gaudy splendour of their dress, their magnificent painters, of whom the prince was Giovanni Bellini, whom Leonardo was eager to meet, of their music, their masked festivals, their flashy ability to show off, their mastery of the art of poisoning. "And all this," he concluded, "I know just from books. Imagine what the real thing will be like." It will be dirty and human, thought Ezio coldly, like everywhere else. But he showed his friend an agreeable smile. Leonardo was a dreamer. Dreamers should be allowed to dream. They had entered a gorge, and their voices echoed off its rocky sides. Ezio, scanning the almost invisible crests of the cliffs that hemmed them in on both sides, was suddenly tense. The outriders had gone on ahead, but he ought to have been able in this confined space to hear the clatter of their horses. However, no sound came. A light mist had sprung up, together with a sudden chill, neither of which did anything to reassure him. Leonardo was oblivious, but Ezio could see that the wagoners had become tense too, and were looking warily about them. Suddenly, a scattering of small pebbles came clattering down the rocky side of the gorge, causing Ezio's horse to shy. He looked up, squinting against the indifferent sun high above, against which he could see an eagle soar. Now even Leonardo was aware. "What's wrong?" he asked. "We're not alone," said Ezio. "There may be enemy archers up on the cliffs above us." But then he heard the thundering hooves of horses, several horses, approaching them from behind. Ezio wheeled his horse to see half a dozen cavalry approaching. The banner they bore was a red cross on a yellow shield. "Borgia," he muttered, drawing his sword as a crossbow bolt hammered into the side of the wagon. The wagoners themselves were already fleeing up the road ahead, and even the oxen were affected, for they lumbered slowly forward of their own volition. "Take the reins and keep them going," Ezio cried to Leonardo. "It's me they're after, not you. Just keep going, whatever happens." Leonardo hastened to obey as Ezio rode back to meet the horsemen. His sword, one of Mario's, was well balanced by its pommel, and his horse was lighter and more manoeuvrable than those of his adversaries. But they were well armoured, and there would be no chance to use his codex blades. Ezio dug his heels into the flanks of his horse, spurring it on into the thick of the enemy. Ducking low in the saddle, Ezio smashed into the group, the force of his charge causing two of their horses to rear violently. Then the swordplay began in earnest. The protective brace he wore on his left forearm deflected many blows, however, and he was able to take advantage of the surprise of a foeman when he saw that his blow did not land to get in a meaningful blow of his own. It was not long before he had unseated four of the men, leaving the two survivors to wheel round and gallop back the way they had come. This time, however, he knew that he must allow no one even the chance of getting back to Rodrigo. He galloped after them, cutting first one and then the other down off his horse as he caught up with them. He searched the bodies swiftly, but neither yielded anything of note. Then he dragged them to the roadside and covered them with rocks and stones. He remounted and rode back, pausing only to clear the road of the other corpses and give them a rudimentary burial, at least enough to conceal them, with the stones and brushwood he had at hand. There was nothing he could do about their horses, which by now had run away. Ezio had escaped Rodrigo's vengeance once more, but he knew the Borgia cardinal would not give up until he was assured of his death. He dug his heels into his horse's flanks and rode to rejoin Leonardo. When he caught up, they looked for the wagoners and called their names in vain.
"I paid them a huge deposit on this wagon and oxen," grumbled Leonardo.
"I don't suppose I'll ever see it again."
"Sell them in Venice.
Don't they use gondolas there?"
"Plenty of farms on the mainland."
Leonardo looked at him.
"By God, Ezio, I like a practical man."
Their long cross-country journey continued past the ancient town of Forli, now a small city-state in its own right, and on to Ravenna and its port on the coast a few miles beyond. There they took ship, a coastal galley on its way from Ancona to Venice, and once he had ascertained that no one else on board presented any danger, Ezio managed to relax a little. But he was aware that even on a relatively small ship like this, it would not be too difficult to slit someone's throat at night and cast their body into the blue-black waters, and he watched alertly the comings and goings at every little harbour they put into. However, they arrived several days later at the Venice dockyards without incident. Only here did Ezio encounter his next setback, and that was from an unexpected source. They had disembarked and were waiting now for the local ferry, which would take them to the island city. It duly arrived, and sailors helped Leonardo move his wagon onto the boat, which wallowed alarmingly under its weight. The ferry captain told Leonardo that some of the Conte da Pexaro's staff would be waiting on the quay to conduct him to his new quarters, and with a bow and a smile handed him on board.
"You have your pass, of course, signore?"
"Of course," said Leonardo, handing the man a paper.
"And you, sir?"
inquired the captain politely, turning to Ezio. Ezio was taken aback. He had arrived without an invitation, unaware of this local law. "But I have no pass," he said.
"It's all right," put in Leonardo, speaking to the captain. "He is with me. I can vouch for him, and I'm sure that the Conte—"
But the captain held up a hand.
"I regret, signore. The rules of the council are explicit. No one may enter the city of Venice without a pass."
Leonardo was about to remonstrate, but Ezio stopped him.
"Don't worry, Leonardo. I'll find a way round this."
"I wish I could help you, sir," said the captain, "but I have my orders."
In a louder voice, directed at the crowd of passengers in general, he announced,
"Attention, please! Attention, please! The ferry will depart at the stroke of 10.
Ezio knew that gave him a little time.
His attention was caught by an extremely well-dressed couple, whom he had noticed joining the galley at the same time as he had, who had taken the best cabin, and who had kept very much to themselves. Now they were alone at the foot of one of the piers, where several private gondolas were moored, and clearly in the middle of a very acrimonious row.
"My beloved, please," the man was saying, a weak-looking type,